Like no food.
Yeah.
Like these are the songs.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I'm Brad Rose. I'm an artist, a composer, a writer, the founder of Foxy Digitalis, and someone who thinks about music and sound far more than is healthy. Each week, I invite on a guest to talk about the songs and the music that has meant a lot to them and left its mark. Previous guests include Glenn Donaldson, Ethan Miller, Claire Rousset, Wendy Eisenberg, the list goes on. I don't know. There's so many amazing people who've been on the show. This week, we added that list with the one, the only, Charmaine Lee. I'm so excited to have Charmaine on because, well, she is one of those artists that is creating things and doing things that literally nobody else is. Like, it sounds like nothing anybody else is doing. And the year 2025, that is a hell of a thing. In addition to having a new album coming out in October called Tulpa, she has started a new label called, I hope I pronounced this right, Co Records. It's her and her partner Randall Dunn, and I'm really excited about this label project. We talk a lot about it in the intro, so I'm not going to go too into it. But there's four releases coming in October, kind of the first cohort. In addition to that. So, new label, new album. Charmaine's about to go on a 95-day tour. 90 cities, all 50 states, 3 months. And this is her saying it, not me. She calls it the dumbest thing she's ever going to do in her life. And that makes me so happy. I think it's incredible. I'm not going to say too much here. I love Charmaine. I think she's amazing. This episode was so much fun. This is like the longest intro section. Like our before we start talking about the songs, it's probably the longest intro section that I've ever had on this show. But there was just so much to talk about, and it could have kept going. Like this could have been a 4-hour episode. But yikes. Anyway. Go see her on tour. She's probably coming to your town or near there if you're in the U.S. I will link to the tour dates, the label, all that in the show notes, of course. This is just a goddamn wonderful time. I hope you all enjoy it. My guest today is a vocalist, a composer, artist, musician, educator, writer, I don't know, everything you can think of and more. It's Charmaine Lee.
Welcome to the
show. So how's it going?
I'm going good. I'm in New York. It's really hot. And I am psychologically, spiritually, emotionally preparing to be away over 95 days. Just 3 weeks.
So since you brought it up, we'll start there. So you described the tour. This made my day when your video you posted is the dumbest thing you'll probably ever do in your life.
I mean, for context for people they don't know, basically, how do I contextualize it? So you can probably tell by my accent, I'm Australian, and I've lived in the US for, gosh, since 2010, so 15 years. Wow. But a good chunk of that was like in school, and then after I graduated, I did a master's at NEC, and after I graduated, I really wanted to be in New York and just really go balls to the wall with music, but because, you know, being Australian, I didn't really have many options in terms of staying. So I ended up getting a a full-time job that sponsored my visa. And I was on a series of visas for over 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And then that, you know, my job ended up actually sponsoring my green card. So once I had that, a lot of things started changing for me. And, you know, prior to that point, I basically wouldn't be able to take more than 3 days off work. So I, right. The concept of a tour just was never possible.
Right.
And in sort of true Charmaine fashion, I kind of go from my partner Randall kind of describes me as someone who just like runs into a burning building like all the time. And I just sort of was like, you know what? I have never toured in my life. What is the most extreme version of what this can be? And I'd also, because of that, I have, there's so much of this country I haven't seen.
Right.
And I'm convinced that there's something there to that. And obviously I think we can all agree that, that our online understanding of that is just totally false, or at least completely one-sided in some dimension. And I've started to see glimpses of that because Randall and I will go on weekends, we'll just hop in the car and we'll go to like rural Pennsylvania or, you know, even just around the East Coast. And even within that proximity, there's just such great, such diverse ways of living and communities and like Amish towns and, you know, local markets and flea markets. And you'll see these bits of local histories around that you just don't see online. And the tactile nature of that, to be able to hold those objects or feel it and see it and breathe it, it's really convinced me that this is a really good time. It's a fucked up time, but it's because of that, I think, the perfect time to be kind of plunging into that. And so I ended up last year, at the end of last year, I quit my job and I started planning this very elaborate idea. And Randall is completely crazy enough to do this with me. But I'm very lucky because he's toured, you know, over the course of, you know, he's been doing music for 3-4 decades. And I think over the course of that time has toured many times throughout the country and internationally. So I feel very spoiled because I have the kind of wisdom of someone like him on the road with me. And at the same time, I'm like, it's one of those things where it's like, you don't know what you don't know. So like, I don't even know what I'm not prepared for.
Right.
In some fashion.
I think that's amazing. And I, you know, again, I live in Oklahoma, a place that not a lot of people ever, again, it's a very one-sided picture that most people have. I mean, I remember, so my partner, she's from Seattle, and 20 plus years ago when we first met, I remember she worked at a place down at Pike Place Market, and I was talking to her boss and he was like, so do you remember the first time you ever saw a tree? And I was like, dude, it's not the Dust Bowl anymore. Like, but everybody thinks we live in the Dust Bowl. And then everyone thinks, and when we were moving back, her family was like, oh, so are you living on a farm? It's like, no, I'm in it's a city. Like, there's, it's just like a.
Right. We just picture the rolling, the rolling tumbleweed, like running across the screen. And like, there's just you, like, blogging. Like, right.
But it's cool. And then, but again, like, then outside of, you know, the cities here. So, like, she works for one of the tribal nations here, which, and that, their headquarters is a small town, an hour and a half outside of any city. But then you know, you see, like you were saying, different ways of living and different ways of taking care of community. And
absolutely.
It's, I mean, it's just, yeah, I think it's so cool. Like that you're doing that. And I think, yeah, this is the time. This is the time people need to be doing more stuff like this. 'Cause
yeah,
if there is a way through it, all this shit, it's these kind of things.
It's also like the timing is feels good on a personal level, but I also think culturally, from what I've been seeing, a lot of the generation that really valued what I was saying, was sort of preservation of local histories, mm-hmm. Collections, physical objects, mm-hmm. they're all starting to die. Like that yeah. generation, right? Like they're all well into their 80s now, mm-hmm. late 70s, 80s onwards. And I feel like, and even like roadside attractions, you know, people mm-hmm. who really put love and care into maintaining these incredible places of interest, mm-hmm. I feel like are starting to pass, and I'm not sure that there is a generation under that is interested, genuinely interested in continuing that.
Right.
And that scares me. That makes me sad, but it also kind of further invigorates me with this urgency that is like, if I want to see this specific era of America, this version, mm-hmm. as it's been known, you know, this is the time now, because these things may not be around for much longer.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
No, I think that's, yeah, I can't wait to, like, once you, it's done, to like hear about just, I don't know, your sort of reflections on all of it, or what, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that's going to take you so long to process everything.
I know, in classic Charmaine fashion, I'm like, I think 10 days after I get back, I'm playing at a festival in Edinburgh, in Scotland. Of course. And I'm just like, nope, like, cannot stop.
No. Well, hey,
it's too much.
I know. If we stop, we have to start.
Well, everyone tells me, like, some of my close friends who do this a lot, mm-hmm. who are on the road, you know, 4 months of a year or something like that, 4 or 5 months a year, they always tell me that it's actually not the tour itself you need to be worried about per se. It's actually coming back and what you choose to do with your time, because the inclination is to just drop everything and just collapse.
Right.
But that's also could be the most depressing experience you can have. I mean, you're like on the road, you're playing for people that are clapping for you, like on a stage. Yeah. You have this incredibly like binary experience of that, and then like sitting in a car, like driving on these like incredibly boring highways. You know, it's just, it's an extreme experience. And then in the meantime, your personal life's like gone to shits. People are dying. People are breaking up with you. Like there's all sorts of crap that's happening. And then you come back and then what? You know, that's the big kind of looming question. So a lot of people who are much more experienced than me are sort of saying, yo, like get busy. Get busy when you get back.
Hop on a plane to Scotland.
Just leave the country entirely.
Yeah. See all of the country and then get the hell out.
Get the hell out.
Oh, man. Well, good luck. I'm excited that, you know, Tulsa will be one of your stops, but
absolutely.
It's going to be, it's going to be an incredible experience.
And we'll before make we get, you're going to play a vocal.
Yeah.
Oriented set for the first time in 15 years.
That's the plan. Hopefully we'll pull it off. I don't know.
Something will happen.
So before we get into the songs, I obviously, you got a new album out, which is kind of what prompted all this, and a new label. So yeah. Why did you decide to start a label in 2025?
I know. Again, like, is this the dumbest decision that I'll ever make in my life? We're kind of on that theme now, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, it's like, I don't know, we're living in a time of collapse. Like,
exactly.
Smoke them if you got them, right?
I know. Well, and I still think this is my hypothesis. I mean, what we're seeing on the commercial side of music, specifically, you know, the stuff that primarily gets consumed on Spotify. Mm-hmm. Lo-fi beats, mood music, things that are, you know, supposed to kind of support an additional activity most of the time.
Right. Yeah.
Obviously, we're seeing that's getting displaced so fast by AI-driven music. Mm-hmm. You know, what's that company? Sora? Sono?
Sono? Soro? Sonos? Something like
not
that.
Not Sonos, yeah. But...
Yeah.
Sora? Yeah, I'm blanking on it now. Yeah, Sora. We're seeing so much of that is happening and, like, at, frankly, just impressive levels of execution. Yeah. And I started to just develop this feeling, this theory that what is going to happen, and I believe is already starting to happen, is there's going to be just a mass bifurcation mm-hmm. in art, and it's already happening in visual art and graphic design. But now with music, you know, we're going to have a lot of this slop that a lot of it gets really... primarily becomes AI generated music mm-hmm. that is like music for your workouts, like music right. to study to. And what I believe, and this is where I'm kind of taking my bet, is that the stuff that is very handmade, bespoke, human centric, that's the stuff that will become even more valuable over time. Yeah. That's the stuff that actually really matters culturally, that people will want to both invest in but also care about and want mm-hmm. to interact with, because so our kind of digital spheres are becoming so just completely past saturation with and everything is starting to just completely like collide in a way that I genuinely think people are just fatigued by, and it doesn't move them. Mm-hmm. And from what my own personal experience, I feel like there's this yearning for things that are made by people that are idiosyncratic, that are not driven by genre or by algorithm or by marketing incentives, but are really driven by some person's pure curiosity and interest in the world and in cultures mm-hmm. and their desire to kind of synthesize that into some of their own version of that, their own system of meaning and their own language. And I think that's really the ethos of the label and why I felt like there wasn't a context for that right now, mm-hmm. In especially coming out of the US. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Randall and I feel really passionately about, is this, there's a central American quality to the label that has its mm-hmm. roots in jazz, has its roots in American music, really. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's lacking sorely right now. And so I teamed up with Randall, who is an incredible producer and engineer and musician in his own right, who has really a understanding of the studio like it is an instrument, and is very just fluid and creative with that. And he's also recorded, I think, over 600 records over his career, which is bonks, totally crazy. Yeah. And so you can imagine the amount of processes that he's seen, like artists doing their thing.
Yeah.
That level of exposure and the kind of knowledge of that is incredibly just special. And so the ability to work with these artists, you know, the label, we're trying to do this from the ground up, where it's not just like, send us your WAV files and, you know, it's this, we're coming together, all of us, in the studio over a concentrated period of time. Cool. And we're working with each artist, honoring their processes, but also recognizing that it's a collaboration and really making this a real conversation and having improvisation be a heavy part of that process. But it's been such a, we're now 8 records in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we're the amount of breadth of being able to see that across each different artist is mind blowing for me personally, from my perspective. Yeah. I mean, this whole entity is like a selfish project for me to be able to see how rad people make shit.
I know that's so legit. Like, that's really amazing. I've heard the first 4, so I don't even know what the second 4 are, but that come later. But that's an amazing approach. And like, so one thing that we did last year at our house is we turned my kids' playhouse into basically a backyard micro art gallery, and we do art shows.
Like the coolest parents.
Well, we try, but so yeah. And
that's speaking awesome.
Of Warren Realwriter, who we were talking about, he has a show opening on Saturday at our gallery.
What?
But yeah, so it's like I don't think it'll still be up in October, but
that's cool.
We'll see. I don't know. It's anyway, but part of my whole thing was, I mean, just having a space to get people in physical proximity with each other, because I think right now that is super important. But 100%. Also, yeah, it was like, I want to see behind the curtain of people's processes and collaborate with them on just making things for this tiny space. And it's a total like selfish thing on my part. It's like, I want to just, see cool people do cool shit and learn from it.
It's been it's changed me chemically. Like, it's changed my music. Yeah. It's changed how I think about art. It's actually like, it really feels chemical. That's amazing. Evolution of that. And it's really beautiful to see, because as each record gets made, the context of the prior record changes.
Oh,
so it
yeah.
becomes this like this entity that takes on its own personality, and to see that and to kind of start to see, you know, the way that we're approaching the releases is like these cohorts. So a few times a year, you know, we'll have these batches of these records made, but it's very intentionally designed, because what we're trying to do is create this intergenerational dialogue between people. You know, for example, we just recorded David Torn, who's going to be on the label, and, you know, he's in his 70s, and we have that with, you know, for example, Aaliyah Alton, who's an incredible cellist, who's not even 30 at this stage. Yeah. And that kind of intergenerational dialogue, I think, is also grossly lacking and missing.
Totally agree.
The general art universe right now. Right. But I think context is so important. And it's amazing to see the ways that each artist is shaping that on their own, and sort of the evolution of that. From my perspective, having seen things from zero to from the ground up is mind blowing.
That's so awesome. I could sit here and talk about this forever, but then we'd be here all day and people probably be like, dude, get on with the show. But
I just want to hear about the songs.
We just want to hear about these damn songs. So how do you pronounce the label name? Is it Ku?
So it's the Chinese, I guess, phonetic is K-O-U. Uh-huh. And it's pronounced "kou," which means mouth in Chinese.
Okay,
so it's sort of Italian to language, vocals.
Yeah,
yeah.
And your record is called Tulpa.
Yes, and that is it's sort of Tibetan terminology to describe the conjuring of an alternate being, and I think this album is very much that, in terms of the kind of expression of many worlds and of many personalities and characters, and that gets expressed then through, in the studio setting, the variety of colors, timbres, extremities of noise and spectral richness that emerges. You know, it was really amazing because, you know, in the studio, Randall basically set up an array of vintage tube amps, guitar tube amps, around me like a cave.
Oh, wow.
And then we sent the signal through each of these amps, including a Leslie cabinet, which is like mind-blowing.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so I was able to engage with not only the live feedback response from each of these amps, but obviously the colors of them, which are totally interesting and weird and different. And the mixing process then became this really cool creative process where we were able to musically, dimensionally shift through these different amps and colors, and how that kind of changes the quality of how you listen is really powerful and for me a relatively pretty new experience, having mainly been live performing and having had my last album, which was done in my bedroom, like, you know, classic style. And to be able to have that three-dimensional engagement and that space was really inspiring and new.
That's really cool. Yeah. I mean, like one of the words that kept coming to mind when I was listening to it is it felt very like sculptural.
Yes.
And describe that. So that three-dimensional, like exactly what you're just like, oh yeah. Okay. That makes perfect sense.
Well, I was listening to a lot at that time. I was listening to a lot of like Miles Davis 70s records. And I was just thinking, like, and like Funkadelic, and I was just thinking, like, how come? I was like, God, these records just feel like delightfully rude. It's like the way that I would describe it. It's like there's something about production of that era, and Randall's really opened my eyes to a lot of that too. Is like these things were not polite, and the way they were recorded, especially like on tape and all these truly experimental methods of that time, they weren't afraid to be bold with the sound and with the mixing and make decisions that were strong, you know? And I think we've kind of gotten more and more squished, especially with most commercial music. It's just like flattened into this very narrow band. And I think that genuinely affects why we're, how we're listening. And to be able to broaden that back out and be able to have the full palette of how sound actually moves through you in your body, and to be a little bit rude about it, I think is kind of a core ethos to the label too. Is like these things are made by people, and you should feel the presence of that when you hear something. Yes.
Yeah, no, I feel that. I love that. Okay, I'm gonna I want to keep talking about this, but I'm gonna stop because this is, I think this is like the longest intro section I've ever done.
Oh,
but
God, that's sorry. Totally.
Oh God! Don't apologize.
It's okay. The song part will be really short because
we'll just blow through this. Nobody cares.
Whiz through that. Yeah.
Well, the record is out. Well, I don't. It's not out now. Actually, it's out.
It's
soon.
It's coming out soon. It'll be out very soon, and we'll post about that when it's released officially. Yeah,
and I will at least link to.
I will have the physical copies on tour with me though, so I will be traveling with all four records in my car. And hopefully that'll incentivize people to get out. But that will be physically ready for me to travel with when I leave on August 11th.
In 3 weeks. Jeez.
Yep. God, I'm not ready.
Oh, well, it's coming no matter what. So you'll be you'll on the 11th, wherever you are, you'll be going. Okay. I have no segue here, so we're just going to go into it.
All right, let's do it.
And as ever, First question is, what is the first song that you remember?
Tower of Power, Don't Change Horses.
God.
That song, I feel like, defines the first 7 years of my life.
I love it.
My dad is a pretty killer amateur jazz guitarist, and that's kind of where I first just came to listen to music.
Yeah.
And I loved to sing, so I really loved Ella and Sarah and Billy and just all the classics. But really the first point of sonic references, my dad, who is like classic like dad jazz lover. So I grew up listening to like Tower of Power, yeah, George Benson, Pat Metheny, Earth, Wind and Fire, you name it. And so that specific sound, especially, you know, that Back to Oakland album, Tower of Power, like,
oh man,
woo, that goes so deep. And it's really funny. I had a rocking horse as a kid, like when I was really young. Uh-huh. It's like one of the classic rocking horse. And I would get on the rocking horse and I would get dad to play that song.
Oh, that's amazing.
As I was a kid, and I would just go for it on this rocking horse. And I would just be screaming. Oh. And there was this, you know, in the chorus, it's like, giddy up, giddy up. And I just be like, you know,
oh my God.
Wow. I still live in a rocking horse and my home in Sydney. Wow. Epic.
Man, that's down the road, that'll be in the Charmaine Lee Museum. Oh, that's awesome. I think I think Tower of Power is such an underrated group. I don't
know. Right? Like, God, that section is redonkulous.
Oh, so good. This song, yeah, I love this song. It's so like bright and funky and just makes you be thankful to be alive or something.
Yes, yes.
But man, now I'm sad I don't have a rocking horse memory of like some funk song. That's incredible. Yep. Well, okay. A little less rocking horse centric here, but what's a song that'll make you cry? And are you a crier? Do you think of yourself
I cry constantly. Okay. This was so hard for me to answer because I literally, like, you put a couple of sus chords or like you go from like 1 to 4 in uh-huh. the functional harmony, and like I'm in tears. Like I'm literally like,
so the answer to this could be like most song.
Yeah, I know. It's like there's something about, and this is like, well, and it kind of like unravels, I think, in the rest of our conversation, but like I'm a big emo. Like I'm a sucker for emo stuff. Yeah. And because I grew up, you know, and I was telling you before, like I grew up like real basic biatch. Like I didn't really get hip to like hip music till that was like maybe in my early 20s. So before that, it was all like Whitney, Mariah, Britney, you know, right. All of them. I loved my jazz folks, but then it was like I grew up, you know, in the early 2000s. I was a teenager, and so that was like Simple Plan, Green Day, you know, like this whole era, Blink 182, and I was obsessed. Like that shit hit me so deep. And then in Australia, like we didn't get all the latest, you know, the only way that I knew what was going on were these. Well, firstly, pop music was basically banned in my house, which is crazy, but essentially it was like jazz or classical. And like, that was sort of it. And I was really, I loved pop. Like I just had this total, my sonic, like, My excitement was just so into that specific era. And so the only way for me to know was like these now compilations.
Oh, yeah.
Which were from every year they would like put out the top hits. Yeah. And they were primarily American, UK. And so I would secretly buy these now compilation CDs in my Walkman. And at night I would be like listening to the now of, you know, 2005, you know, I was totally clandestine. Incredible. And I I loved, yeah, I was just a sucker for, I will never say, I was like 13 and I saw Green Day live with Simple Man. Plan. And I was totally like, this is, you know, this is my shit.
Yeah, I mean, some of the most formative stuff for me when I was a teenager, so I'm older, I was a teenager in the like early to mid 90s, but it was, I mean, it was that same kind of like pop punk stuff. Like, I mean, Green Day was one of them. I did a whole, like, Rancid was one of the most formative bands to me ever. I did it to the point that a friend of mine and I, a couple years ago, did an 80 plus episode podcast entirely about Rancid.
I need to hear this.
It's they're very problematic, but so it's, you know, it's fine. So I totally, I get that.
So that has followed me, period. That sort of, that kind of general vibe in that world. Yeah. But then I put Groupa, I think Clearing, which is like, opposite from that. I know, but it's sort of like this, it's like this weird, like much more refined,
mm-hmm,
and tragic rendition of
that's
for me. And I think she's extraordinary. And I had a friend, had an ex-boyfriend show me her music about 10 years ago, and I just collapsed, basically. I was like, this is like perfect in every way. And that was when she came out with the album Ruins, which is what Clearing is on, and it's just and a piano, and it's on tape, and it just destroyed me. Like, and the lyrics are also just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And I actually ended up seeing her live. Yeah, that's right. She and Basinski did a back-to-back performance at PS1 in like 2015. And I went to go see it. And it was actually very interesting, because she got up on stage and she was kind of like this.
Right. Yeah.
She was like, and like no one could see her. She was like hiding behind her.
Yeah.
Like the most antisocial performance that I'd probably seen in a really long time. And everyone was really uptight, because there was just, we didn't know what was going on, and it was really intense. And she was so kind of introspected and hiding. And so everybody was really like stiff after her performance. And Basinski comes out and he like walks up to the mic and he's just like, "What's up, you fuckers?" And we're all just like, "Oh." And he's just like, "Don't do drugs. Move to LA and you'll get them for free." Just totally like,
wow.
We're like, what? But that show was crazy and really powerful and really changed me. But man, I love Groupa. I think she's kind of a genius. And that song just wrecks me. Totally wrecks
me. Oh, yeah. It's just like a raw open wound or something. It is so, I don't know. There are also very harmony.
Some academic should do a harmonic study of Rupert's music, because it's really deep. It's actually beautiful, and the changes she makes actually on the piano, like the way her ear works, it's actually very idiosyncratic to her. And someone should do some like study. Yeah.
No kidding. I mean, there's, I don't know, I can't think of very many artists who, for as long as I recorded an episode yesterday and we were talking about Groupa on that one too, different song, but same general feeling of just, her music is just like, it just will kind of destroy you, but in the best possible way.
Exactly.
Wow. What a show though. Okay. Complete opposite end of the spectrum here. What's a song that'll put you in a better mood?
So I put Evanescence, Bring Me to Life, because that is my go-to choice of song in karaoke.
Oh, nice. And
every time I feel like I emerge as a different person. But the last time I did that was at Cafe Otto.
Oh my God.
I know, it was actually kind of absurd. I just performed a solo set and I don't know what happened, but sometimes at Otto, the hang just gets really, something happens where chaos ensues and sometimes the hang just gets really wild and someone just started going on this obsessive idea that we were going to go do like a post hang karaoke session at Otto with all these people that happened to just stay there after the show. And I got on the mic and just ripped a version of this song. A whole bunch of people who were like, didn't this girl just like an abstract noise set with her voice like 20 minutes before?
I mean, that's kind of in the same realm of Whiplash of like Grouper and then Basinski getting up there right after and being like, hey, fuckers.
Exactly.
I love it. Oh, man. Yeah,
but I love it. I have a soft spot for that music. I think it's killer. I also think it's a great, it's like, in a karaoke setting too, it's a mic dropper, and it's something that just everyone, you can't help but just like scream at the sky.
You know? Right. Yeah. That, yes. This would be a good like hype song too. Like a later question you're not going to do, but yeah. Okay. Everybody's favorite question. What is objectively the greatest song of all time?
Again, this one took me so long to figure out because there's just so much good music. But I think if I were to play an alien, like if like someone was like, what is the Earth? And I was just to play like the golden record that they would have.
Yeah.
The first track would be Phil Collins, In the Air.
Like, I love it.
Come on.
It's the greatest drum fill of all time.
Greatest drum fill of all time. Greatest sampler of all time. Greatest vocal performance of all time.
Yeah. Greatest the whole vibe of the song is just weird.
It's weird. Yeah. It's so painfully weird and amazing.
Yeah. It's funny. So like I was talking to somebody about this when I got your list. So a song that comes up in the Patreon section about least favorite song, the song that comes up the most is Hotel California.
I should have said that.
I was thinking about that because like Hotel California, it's like so ubiquitous. It's like part of the zeitgeist at this point. Yeah. You know? I mean, it's just,
yeah.
But so is this song, really. But this song fucking rules. And like, this song, fuck Hotel California. Like,
dude, and also, I feel like it just ages well. Like, there's this music that ages really well. And I feel like anytime that song comes on, the world just kind of pauses for a minute, you know?
Yes.
And I grew up, like, you know, in Sydney. And like I was saying, we didn't get hip music until like 6 months down the road after it was released. And there was this one radio station, 106.5, that I was like low-key obsessed with. And they had this guy, Richard, I think his name was Richard Mercer. He had the sexiest voice of all time. And he would do he would do like the nightly hour music.
Yeah.
And they'd play this music and I'd be in the car at like a 9 o'clock in Sydney, like driving, and that would come on. It just hits. It's deep.
Oh, I love it. I think it's, I'm going to have to, so my kid is 12 and I'm going to have to play this for it, see how it goes over like for a 12 year. I don't know.
I think 12, you're probably ready.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Not earlier. I think 12 is sort of the prime age to start teasing the rope.
We'll have to try. No, I'm, this song has never come up on like nearly 100 episodes of this, and so I'm really glad that you, somebody finally picked it, because it is fucking awesome. Okay, what is the a song that you used to love, but you heard it recently, or if you think about it now, doesn't
Yeah, so I originally put a song in there, but then I removed it, and I put an entire period of music. Oh,
I don't think I saw that. I just saw the song.
I put 2006 to 2012.
Just the whole time?
Because, well, okay, just to be clear, I feel like there was a very, and this is music that, again, I was a teenager for, I was in high school. So this is the music that was like coming in to my world that I thought was like really cool. And now looking back, I'm like, what? Like this is a very specific era. It's about a 5 or 6 year period, 2006, 2012, of indie adjacent music. So that's like the Magnetic Zeros, Band of Horses, Edward Sharpe. Even like the more kind of Brooklyn jazz adjacent, like Dirty Projectors. There's a whole era of this very specific indie music.
I know what you're talking about.
I feel like it doesn't age well. It hasn't aged well.
I feel like I've forgotten most of it, like even exists.
I just feel like it, when I hear it now, I'm like, oh. Like it was either like way too like post Christian church music, earnest adjacent stuff that just doesn't age well, and it's just frankly just kind of lame, or it was like excessively trying to be complex or artful in a way that. At the end of the day, lacks the actual soul of what for me.
Yes.
Okay, so like maybe there's some aspect that's racially like it's in there too, right? Like it's like primarily white extractions of black music that then get conformed into this like indie.
Yeah, this very
raw context. Yeah, right. And there's something that just doesn't age well. It hasn't aged well for me personally.
No, I totally get that. And think about like to our earlier conversation, you know, you're talking about like those Miles Davis records and like Funkadelic and how it was like very brash and rude. And this is music with every edge sort of sanded off of it.
Removed. Yes.
And it's just totally forgettable.
Yes. Mumford and Sons. Now I remember that one.
That was, oh God.
And it was all tied into like Rough Trade, like that specific kind of era of Rough Trade and like Urban Outfitters.
Yeah.
Oh just God. Yeah. Whole movement, American Apparel, you know, that it just, that era of American cultures.
Yeah, it just all was like, it was all branding. It wasn't even art at all. It was just like,
I think totally everybody was getting like crazy because the iPod came out and like their whole ad campaign was happening, you know?
Yeah,
and it just doesn't age very well, basically.
Yeah, gosh. Feels like that's like where a lot of, I don't know, you think of some of the issues today that we have in music and art. I think it's like a lot of it was seeded.
Yep.
Okay. That's a really good answer. Your other answer was good too, but we won't get into that.
That's basically the same thing.
Well, it is. And I don't want to talk about Radiohead. What is the song that most people hate? Whoever these people are, I don't know. People hate it. You don't care. You love it.
Yeah, that's my whole emo thing. I'm basically a huge sucker for anything by American Football, like early the EPs. I think it's incredible. That Midwestern emo sound. Caballero, Don Caballero, American Football, Captain Jazz, when, you know, it, that whole era, I'm kind of a huge sucker for. I think it's awesome. I love guitar music. I think that the cool thing that I like about that period is a lot of the, oh, there's this great band too. I think they only had like two records, Piglet, also from, I think, from Chicago. Mm-hmm. Totally killer music. I think the thing I love about it is, like, you know, there's math components to it, like, oh, an odd time signature or
right.
whatever, but I genuinely don't think that's what any of these guys were thinking when they were writing the music.
Right.
And they really were, like, engaging with the guitar and with sound in a way that felt so personal. And I love that specific era because it feels that way. Like, the music really feels that way. Like, before people started to over-intellectualize that and get, like, way too clever with things, there was this, like, genuine earnestness that I feel when I hear that music. And
yeah,
I'm a sucker for it.
Yeah, no, I think some of this stuff, I don't know when American, for those EPs came out. I think it was, like, I was older. But it reminds me a lot. Are you familiar with the band Seam?
Seam, S-E-A-M?
Uh-huh.
No.
So they were like a 90s Chicago, still one of my favorite bands of all time. And it was the same kind of thing you're talking about.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And
I think, like, American Girl was 99.
Okay. So, yeah.
Yeah.
99, that was about when I was...
Yeah.
I was getting into, like... Yeah, I don't know. Whatever. Doesn't matter. I wasn't listening to emo at that point. Although I was still listening to Seam. Like, I still listen to Seam. It's like, they had a record called, is it, Are You Driving Me Crazy or You're Driving Me Crazy? I don't know. I still listen to that record. You'd probably like it. And it's, but yeah, I love that same kind of thing where it's like very guitar driven and very.
Yes.
It's, you know, I mean, this is music that is very complex, but not for the sake, like you're saying, like, they weren't thinking about that. Whereas the stuff we were talking about before, they were trying to be complex and it just came off as
nothing. Douchey.
Yeah. This was just, I don't know. It was these people, like, really in their feelings and, like,
yes.
but yeah, And every time I have listened to American Football, I'm like, okay, like, I get it. Like,
I was freaked out because I saw this, like, a few years ago. I saw this video of them, like, they're doing some reunion tour or something.
Uh-huh.
And the camera that was, like, them performing I don't remember, some festival in America. And the camera, like, pans and, like, someone's playing the vibraphones and the camera's, like, panning to the vibraphone playing. I'm like, what the fuck? That's my friend Corey.
Oh.
Corey Bracken, who's, like, a killer vibes player. Like, joined the band and is, like, still touring with them.
That's amazing.
So random. Man.
Dream gig.
I know. I'm like, the fuck? Corey. Yeah.
Man, he needs to hook you up to open for up? American football.
I know. Putting that out there now, guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm ready? I'm available.
Yeah. Gonna be on the road for 3 months?
Yeah. I'm gonna be on the road. If you need an opener, I'm here. I'm here for it.
Oh man, that would be I would pay money to see the audience's reaction to American football audience. Okay, what's the most romantic song?
Oh my gosh. Again, such a hard. I also didn't know if romantic meant, like, sexy romantic or, like.
It's however you want to interpret, like, it. Open to interpretation.
I adore
your
romance, but I love Lita. You know, I love Schumann. Mm-hmm. Clara and Robert, and I also love I love piano music and voice, and so I put On the Music by Schubert, and it's a classic. And I think it's so beautiful and kind of, like, very hard to do wrong if you're performing it, and it's something that I think is timeless and and gorgeous and would woo me any day.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. And there's so many, there's, like, so many good versions of it out there.
Yeah.
What's a song that changed your perspective on an artist, either for better or for worse?
I semi-misread this question because I thought it was about what was a song that changed your perspective as an artist.
Oh, okay. Well, hey, let's go with that.
I put All My Life, Ornette Coleman, on the science fiction album. Because up until that point, I heard that song in my first year, my first week of NEC when I did my master's there. I turned up for an ensemble with Joe Morris, the incredible guitarist, who was doing a ensemble on the properties of free music. And in that, you know, we listened to you and played the music of Ornette and Braxton and Eric Dolphy, Steve Lacy. And I will never forget the first time that I heard that song, because it completely changed my understanding of like what music is or can be, period. And the idea that you could have like a pulsing rhythm section in this complete lockup time, and then having these cascading horn lines coupled with Asha Puthley, who is queen Asha. You know, the way she sings that and the lyrics. I've waited all my life for you, and now you're here. You know, it's like fucking gorgeous. And I had the chance to actually sing that with the ensemble that we were in. And there's something like when you actually perform that, the pieces, your relationship totally changes. So that blew my mind. And I forever was changed. And I was, my whole understanding of collaboration, of improvisation, of songwriting, of harmony, of method, everything changed after that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. This is one you could easily make a case for as like greatest song of all time.
That whole album, I would put up there. I would definitely put up there.
The band on that album. I don't know. I think Ed Blackwell's amazing, one of the greatest drummers to ever live. And the way he drives this song, especially, I mean, it's just, Why? I like that. Hey, that's a great. I like that. You know, we changed it up. That's good. That's beautiful.
Oh yeah.
All right. What about lyrics? Do you pay attention to lyrics? Are you a big lyrics person?
I am, and I'm not. Like the way that I, like with my own music, my relationship to lyrics and words have been fluid. And I think in some ways, you know, how I first started in Joe's ensemble, because I guess he'd been running that ensemble for like 10 years. And I guess I was the first vocalist to have ever signed up.
Oh, wow.
In the entirety of the time he was running this ensemble. So he was kind of like, what do we do with you? And so he encouraged me to he was like, why don't you bring in some poetry? And my friend had this huge anthology of like 20th and 21st century poems. So I would just every week bring in that book and I would open up a random page and then basically would use that poem as a jumping off point to then it eventually became more and more abstract, from words to then syllables and then to sounds. And then, you know, that's kind of how some of the genesis of my vocabulary began. And so now when I think about text, for a long time, it was like, actually what I think in a musical context, what people respond to isn't necessarily the literal words, but I really feel like it's embedded with the actual the suggestion of the diction the actual mm-hmm. syllabic sensory delivery is a huge part of how we receive music. And so that kind of ensued like a 7-year journey of me trying to kind of unpack, like, can I express emotional complexity without necessarily getting too literal with the words? Because once you right. once you start to evoke words, like, then the associations get really intense, and you have to yeah. be like very specific, very, very specific with yeah. that. And I frankly just wasn't ready. Like, I was not ready for a long time to start kind of invoking that. And mm-hmm. I was trying to kind of get at it through the illusion of it. And in some ways mm-hmm. that has led to more interesting results. But these days I've been more thinking more about text and about lyrics and about ways to integrate that, much like I do when I think about melody or when I think about harmony. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because you kind of have to kind of go away from these things for a long time before, you know what I mean? Like, anyone worth yeah. their salt, like, I feel like questions a lot of the things that people portray as just inherent truths. And mm-hmm. when you hear about, when, like, especially at this day and age, if you come to like learn about music, there's so much institutionalized knowledge that just gets like embedded as like fixed right. Right. realities. And I think anyone who has a remotely adventurous brain, like, will kind of try to understand what this is without a lot of those assumptions in place. So text for me was a really big, was yeah. a really big one. But I think what I put there was, again, like, very, a lot of the responses I realized I gave you, like, are very emotionally poignant periods of my life.
Yeah.
And maybe in many ways that actually drives a lot of my feeling around the song, which is obviously natural.
Right.
But that, so I put a kind of little known song from early Bon Iver.
Yeah.
Called Restacks.
I think it's the last song on the first record.
The last song yep. on the very first record of his, yep. which I still maintain is like a killer record.
Oh, it's a beautiful record.
Yeah, it's a beautiful record. I feel like I get like made fun of from people in the art world for liking that record. But I, for me, like, again, I was a senior in high school. I'd just gotten dumped. I was so depressed. And this whole album is about him breaking up with his ex and going to the cabin in the wood, doing the whole thing. Like, the whole fucking shebang.
Yeah.
And this album is like my cabin in the woods. And I listened to this song, like, religiously. And I think for him, like, it's interesting. I feel like, especially those early records, he had like intentionally obfuscated a lot of his words, kind of like Grupo, you know,
the idea
of like the suggestion of things is actually more evocative than sometimes the literal translation of mm-hmm. them, the literal registering of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this song actually was like one of the few on the album where you can really hear the lyrics, and I think they're so beautiful. And I think the one that I pulled are the last two verses.
Mm-hmm.
Should I say them out loud? Or
you can, you know.
All right. There's a black crow sitting across from me. His wiry legs are crossed. He's dangling my keys. He even fakes a toss. Whatever could it be that has brought me to this loss? This is not the sound of a new man or crispy realization. It's the sound of the unlocking and the lift away. Your love will be safe with me. Oh my gosh.
It's so good. I love the crispy realization. It's such a great like combination of words and
just, yeah, and how he sings is like,
yeah,
this is not the sound of a new man or crispy realization.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, it's so good.
It's such a good song.
People
who give you shit for still liking this record, they're wrong. That's okay. I think it's a great record.
I'm glad you validated my love of mainstream.
And I'm pretty sure like one of my like super experimental music noise pals told me about it back in the day, and they were like, dude, I don't know if this is the kind of thing you'd ever find. Of
like you find it. No, wait, what's the right word? Yeah, is it that the right word? Yeah, like it comes to you, that kind of album, like comes to you at a certain time.
Yep. Yeah. You know.
Love
this record. Love this record. What song have you or can you listen to the most?
Oh my gosh. I am low key obsessed with this incredible song by Eamon Kang, who is on the label. Incredible multi-instrumentalist composer, wonderful human being. But he, I think, I don't remember the year it was made. I swear, I want to try to convince him to do a reissue of this album. But this track, Bina, that he wrote, B-I-N-A-H, is one of the most beautiful songs I don't think I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. And Randall was really involved in the recording of that music, actually. I believe Eamon was crashing on his couch during this time.
Wow.
I know. And there's a beautiful story behind it and behind the making of that track. And I think it involves Randall. I think it involves like an incredible tape recording of the Pacific Ocean that's in there, that gets overlaid in the track. And then I'm pretty sure Randall like ran his car over the tape a bunch of times, you know, like it's just a whole, there's a whole process and a story behind that song. And, have you heard this song?
Oh yeah. I think it feels like one of those songs that has always existed somewhere. And like, I haven't like found it or like pulled it out, like create, like there's something like eternal about it.
Exactly. It's like, it always existed.
I don't know what the chord progression is that he's playing, but it's,
oh, I like learned it on the guitar and everything. Oh, it's a I'm obsessed. it's a drop D on the guitar.
Okay.
And the really cool thing is, and Randall tells me this a lot, is like, I think people don't, like people think it's one way, but the fingerings are really weird. And if you actually hear it, he moves the voicings in like kind of a strange fashion. Mm-hmm. So there's a very kind of specific thing that the way he actually plays it to get the right affect, right voicings. But it's a glorious song, and I honestly could listen to that forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, put it on a loop.
Yeah, and, yeah. And,
that's a great song.
Yeah.
On the total other end of the spectrum, what's the sexiest song?
Oh, this is so cringe, and like I'm gonna get so much hate for this because like everyone hates Common's verse on it, but I'm like low key obsessed. So Far to Go, J Dilla. It's like the dream team, J Dilla, right. D'Angelo, Common. Common's verses are, I just, so you know, another fun fact, I know I can recite that whole song, Common's two verses, like in my sleep.
Oh, that's incredible.
I was asleep and I woke up and I guess I'd had it on repeat. You know what? You know, like one of those moments, like one of those nights where you fall asleep. And I had it on my iPod, and I was listening to it, and it was on repeat. And I woke up, and I was like, "What the?" And it played like 300 times. It was epic.
So it's just like permanently embedded in your.
Yeah, absolutely. That song for me, that is low key, hands down, sexiest music.
Hey, I'm not going to argue.
I mean, okay. How many people have said D'Angelo? Like, probably.
D'Angelo kind of lit. This is, yeah, D'Angelo comes up very often. And understandably so. Like, he does make the sexiest music, and he's one of the sexiest humans. Like,
it's ridiculous. I mean, voodoo? What the fuck?
Oh, yeah. How many children out there exist because of voodoo? Like, millions. That's. yeah, one of greatest albums of all time and the sexiest really? Album of all time. Okay, what's the song that means the most to you?
There's an old Irish song, Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah.
And it's about old friends gathering and for old time's sake. And the reason why I chose that song is because it's my mother's favorite song. Oh. And I don't sing conventionally anymore at mm-hmm. this time much at all, except for like one occasion, which is for my mother. And the only time I do that is for her, and that's the song that I that That's she really wants sweet. To sing. And it's her favorite song. So it's a personal one, and it's a really beautiful song too.
It's another one of those songs that feels like eternal, like just something about it feels otherworldly or something.
Yeah, exactly. And the lyrics are beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I have very sentimental attachments to that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
For that reason.
Our moms can still get us to do things that nobody else can.
What
can
exactly. We say? Forever.
Forever and ever.
Yep.
Always all right, be. What's your favorite song?
Oh, my God. Okay. I put Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For You to because there is no greater album, I think, period. There's no greater synergy of talents of Eno and Lenoir and, you know, I mean, look, U2 gets a lot of hate now and Bono's crazy, but that album and that song.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's like, it's a perfect song. I mean, that, yeah, the whole album, it's a perfect song.
Yeah.
I can't, I'd say. Bono is like such a, you know, a clown at this point, and that's fine.
Yeah.
It doesn't change that.
Yeah. Like there's a great, documentary, you've probably seen it, about the making of that album.
Mm-hmm.
So inspiring. Yeah. And inspiring to see the ways that artists took risks and trusted producers.
Yeah.
And the integrity by which they approached songwriting and collaboration. And how producers were able to experiment, like truly experiment with the music.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's like honestly the one of the most perfect examples of like recorded music.
Yeah.
Gone well. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's. I think maybe what you're seeing here is I love music that involves that like basically makes you feel like you're driving down, you know, the Californian desert.
I mean,
like looking out the window.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like rural Oklahoma, but it's the same thing, and just exactly. Windows I mean, look, down.
Maybe because I'm about to drive 20,000 miles, yeah. But. Like, I think there's something there.
Some of my favorite memories are driving in the middle of nowhere for I don't even know why, windows down, music blasting, friends in the car, singing at the top of our lungs, like a song like I still haven't found what I'm looking for. That's living, man.
That's beautiful.
And on that note, That's a great place to stop. So Tulpa is out soon. I don't know. This will be out in a couple weeks, so maybe it'll be available for people to order by then. But if not, just go see Charmaine on tour, because there's a good chance she's coming to your town. Yep. I mean, if you're in the U.S. If you're not in the U.S., well, sorry. But otherwise, yeah. And then the other so the four records, the four first releases are yours. I don't have it's Jessica Kenny.
So Avon Gang's first ever solo instrumental record. Wow. Jessica Kenny also first ever solo record. Mm-hmm. Chloe Kim, who is this incredible Korean Australian drummer who is awesome, like grew up in Seoul playing backbeat in the church, traditional Korean drumming, moved to Sydney to study music, and has fused that with jazz and new music. She's incredible. Mm-hmm. And myself. So that's the kind of opening cohort on this label. And I'm really excited to share that music with you and with folks. And also, you know, we're already well on our way for the next batch of releases. So I'm really, I like things to be kind of zero to one a lot of the time, as maybe this is what you're sensing. And I think the time is now to be doing something like this. And I really believe in the ethos of the label and the sound and the process. And I'm excited to hear what people think.
I can say that all four records are incredible. And small plug, watch Foxy Digitalis, because there will be stuff on all four of them coming, including this podcast, but other interviews and stuff. And yeah, I just find it very inspiring, and I'm just can't wait to see where it goes. So thanks for doing this.
You're the
this
best, was- Brad.
Once again, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Charmaine Lee. Oh, man. What a fun episode. Tulpa is out soon. She's hitting the road, I think, like next week, into next week, by the time this comes out. And yeah, if she comes to your town, go see it. She's coming to my town. I can't freaking wait. Yeah, the new album, Tulpa. Did I mention that? I don't know. I'm recording this on Monday, and it was a long weekend. Yeah, listen to all her picks. Links in the show notes. And if you don't have Charmaine's last album, get that. I don't know, man. She's one of my faves. Thank you all for listening. Please leave a rating or review. All those things. It helps. Gets this in people's ears. You can join the Patreon, patreon.com/FoxyDigitalis. You get extra long episodes and a bit more, you know? Hey, and that ongoing support really helps. So thank you all one more time. Keep on listening to whatever the hell you want.